Good afternoon. House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development come to order Monday, April 4th. Thank you, committee, for doing good work in my absence. We heard some good testimony in the redistricting committee in the South Coast. I was thinking of all of you. We're going to start with 2328, and just as a preview for those in the audience, we'll do House Bill 2328 first in the work session, then House Bill 3225 in the public hearing. Then we'll be opening House Bill 2007 and House Bill 3591 together, then House Bill 2201 and 2202 together, and finally we'll make our way down to House Bill 2327. So we'll start with a work session on House Bill 2328. Mr. Witte, if you'd like to come forward, we're going to ask you to help us through the Dash 8 amendments, which I understand are before the committee. I have them here dated April 1st. Mr. Witte, thanks for coming back.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is James Witte. I'm manager of the Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding at the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I'm happy to be back. The Dash 8s are very similar to the Dash 7s, except for there's a new sentence added to Section 3, and that sentence is on page 4 of the Dash 8s. That's in the subsection 6 that discusses the department establishing standards for the technology that might be involved. And it adds a sentence that says, in developing the standards and systems, the department shall collaborate with other state agencies to integrate information systems currently in use or planned for the future. And the purpose of that is to ensure that the department does not run off on its own without consulting with the other rest of state government to how the system might be integrated with their systems. So it's really a technical amendment that directs the department in a certain way. And that's all it does, other than what the Dash 7s already did.
And is it reasonable, Mr. Weed, just this is as much for my own benefit as anyone else's, that the Dash 7s, now Dash 8s, also move the rate up to parity and add the provisions for the opt-in pilot program?
Yes. The Dash 7s are essentially the Dash 2s with two additions. One is increasing the rate to 1.43 cents per mile, and then adding a voluntary opt-in of 5,000 owners of 5,000 volunteers of light vehicles over 10,000 pounds.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions? Senator Nathanson, this is some of your work, this additional sentence, am I right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And would you like a chance? Perhaps you already did this on Friday when I wasn't here to explain the thinking behind it.
No, I will take a moment and try to be as brief as possible.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I asked for this amendment just because I've observed so many technology projects, sometimes we call them IT projects, over the past few sessions, where we pay a lot of money to do one thing, and then a few years later, we are looking at spending some hundreds of thousands, if not a few million dollars, to make one system talk to another system. And it's unfortunate that we've gotten to that place, but in government, we have to make sure that we're doing things efficiently and break out of our silos and break down those walls or those barriers that exist between departments. I think it's very important, whether we're talking about Department of Transportation or Department of Revenue, or a specific area, such as DMV within ODOT. That's one area. There are other areas within ODOT. I think it's important to have the confidence that our systems will be designed in collaboration with other departments that already have some of the data, perhaps, that this department is going to start collecting, or vice versa. Maybe if the system were designed in a certain way, it would also benefit one or two other departments that it needs some information either as background or some other data purposes. Anyway, it's the sort of thing that I wish we didn't have to legislate doing something well and doing it that way, but after seeing a number of projects, whether it's human services or energy and environment, other areas, I just thought it would be good to start this one out on the right foot and say everybody's going to talk to everybody else and make sure that this data is compatible and that we're working together when we design systems.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we do have the necessary paperwork, and House Bill 2328 has a subsequent referral to the Revenue Department. So I think we're ready to go if the committee is ready to do it.
Mr. Chair, I move that the Dash 8 amendments dated April 1st be adopted.
Thank you. Representative Sheehan moves the Dash 8 amendments dated April 1st. Is there any discussion of the motion? I don't see any. Is there any objection to the motion? I don't see any. The Dash 8 amendments are adopted. Representative Sheehan?
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2328, as adopted, to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. I think I can change that just a little bit.
All right.
No problem. Representative Sheehan moves House Bill 2328 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion of the motion? Representative Smith moves hand. I'll come to you, Representative Widener.
On Friday when this came about, I mentioned that I'd wanted to hear from the EV manufacturers. I heard the folks in Seattle were cool, but I hadn't heard from the manufacturers, sort of the electric vehicle community in Oregon. And I tried to reach out to a couple of them. I hadn't been able to hear back between Friday and today. Wondering if we have any additional information in the room or that we've gathered about that. You know, I offered that question and concern earlier if it was sort of a significant or a less significant burden on that community, and wanted to hear from that. Don't know if we have any information.
Haven't seen any that at least I have not. Representative Widener.
Yeah, I shared some of the same concerns as Representative Nathanson. I still have those concerns because I think we're making this more complex than it needs to be, and I would see that it's not showing any fiscal right now, but I have a feeling we're going to have a large fiscal and a new department that's not taking in very few dollars, I should say, for what we'll be paying out. And I think this is something we should be waiting on, and I think we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Just to be clear, Representative Widener, I want to make sure you know it's going to revenue next, so you're aware of that. Thank you. Any further discussion? I don't see any. It sounds like we ought to have a roll call vote, please.
Representative Lindsey?
Yes.
Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
No.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Chair Vann?
Aye.
Chair Reed?
Aye. Motion having received the required majority is passed. House Bill 2328 goes to the floor with due pass recommendation and on to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Representative Smith?
I just want to make one quick on the record comment. If I get my question answered, just want to, I guess I always reserve that right, but reserve the right to vote yes on the floor. Just want to get that question answered.
Okay. Thank you. And with that, close the work session on House Bill 2328. Next on our agenda, House Bill 3225. So open a public hearing and ask for a summary, Zach.
House Bill 3225 specifies conditions under which new or extended city, street, or county roads may be developed on land designed as urban reserve by a metropolitan service district.
Thank you. Representative Parrish is here, and I think we're hearing we'll see the sign-up sheet up here shortly. So, Representative Parrish, you'd like to get started, please.
Good afternoon, colleagues. I'm Julie Parrish, State Representative for House District 37, representing Tualatin West Lynn. Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today regarding House Bill 3225 and share my reasons for introducing this bill. As a mother and a consumer, I believe that our communities should be ones in which we can live, work, shop, and play within proximity to our homes. In the West Lynn, Wilsonville, Tualatin communities, our residents have a strong connection to our local businesses and a desire to be engaged in community activities. However, a major roadblock to having livable communities has become traffic, which is often delayed beyond all reason, particularly due to high volume of commercial and residential traffic on Highway 99 and Tualatin Sherwood Road at almost any time during daylight hours. So whether it's driving to a soccer game or simply trying to shop in one of the many local businesses in the area, the transportation infrastructure in the area of Portland Metro region, in this area of the Portland Metro region, is sadly insufficient to handle the needs of our community. So a few years ago, I was in charge of buying these soccer trophies for my son's soccer team, and I ordered them from a local business in Tualatin, and my reward for supporting a community business was a nearly two-hour round trip from Westland to Tualatin and back with three kids in the back of the car. So I've learned that unless I've really planned my errands, I'm better off simply avoiding the area altogether. Of course, that also means avoiding dozens of hardworking businesses who could benefit from my patronage, and it also means not attending many of the activities that my children would like to participate in. But as you all know, there's only so many hours in a day, and we're often called upon to make difficult decisions and make do with the means we have before us. So when I was approached by representatives of the South Metro Business Alliance and asked to consider sponsoring this legislation, I was thrilled. The result is a creative solution to a very long-term problem that has existed in my district for many years. In fact, I was not surprised to learn that the moving of freight and people from Newburgh and Tigard south of Highway 99 through Tualatin and on to I-5 has been a topic of discussion for decades. And while we've known this to be a problem for years, and we spent literally millions of dollars discussing and analyzing this condition for more than two decades, these communities have continued to grow, and the traffic problem has become worse, and we've yet to address solving the problem in any meaningful way. The time and money and environmental impact of mired traffic grows worse every year. Each time the challenges have been reviewed, several new issues are resolved, but something always seems to block the final resolution in some way. But there's a good ending to this story for all of us because so many people have been working on this problem for so long that nearly every single problem that one can imagine has been in some manner addressed. That isn't until last summer when one last roadblock, and no pun intended, was thrown up again, and that's brought us here today. So the bill before you today, which when passed, will finally allow the communities in the South Metro area, Tualatin, Westland, Wilsonville, Sherwood, to hopefully bring to a close a long-standing issue that has challenged these communities for years. It will provide much-needed transportation infrastructure and allow and actually create hundreds of new jobs, which many of us promised our constituents we'd do this legislative session. This project also has the potential to positively impact neighboring communities by opening up jobs that will keep commuters closer to home. Live, work, shop, play. That's a good definition for what livable communities do. With that, I would actually like to pull up Mr. Trey Chanter. I believe he's on the list, if that's okay. He's the founder of the South Metro Business Alliance, and he'll explain the bill to you in a little bit greater detail than I will, or I can, and share the purpose and objective. So I thank you for the opportunity today to hear this important piece of legislation and would certainly urge you to pass the bill, help put Oregonians back to work, and enhance the livability for thousands of citizens in the South Metro area.
Thank you, Representative Parrish. That's fine to bring up Mr. Trey. I didn't quite catch the pronunciation, Chanter. At the same time, I might ask Bob Rindy to come up as well to bring the department's perspective. We have a number of other people who will be wanting to testify, so please come forward. While they're getting settled, we can see if there are any questions for you.
Great.
Does the committee have any questions for Representative Parrish? I don't see any.
Right.
So, Representative Parrish, you're welcome if you need to get to another committee. Come right ahead. And since that seat is vacant, Metro Councilor Carl Hostica, if you could join us, and we'll hear from these gentlemen and then from you. Mr. Cantor, if you'd like to.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Benson Reed and members of the committee. My name is Trey Chanter. I'm founder of the South Metro Business Alliance, which is an organized coalition of businesses throughout Tualatin, Sherwood, Wilsonville, and West Lynn. We work cooperatively with the respective chambers of commerce from those cities, but focus our efforts on matters regarding transportation, land use, and economic development. I am here today to provide you with some background you may need to clearly understand our request for House Bill 3225 and to urge you to adopt this legislation today. House Bill 3225 was introduced by Representative Julie Parrish at our request as an attempt to resolve several longstanding problems that have an impact on the South Metropolitan area of Portland. I am intimately familiar with the majority of those issues because I also happen to be the managing director of Rasmussen Mercedes, which has dealerships located in both Portland and Wilsonville. In better economic times, I employed about 100 Oregonians from the South Metro area and provided family wage jobs and benefits to those folks. That number of people has dramatically decreased over the past 2 to 3 years, but Don Rasmussen Mercedes remains a going concern throughout the region. From my office in Wilsonville, I sit daily and watch the traffic on Interstate 5 traveling both northbound and southbound slow down and become increasingly congested on a daily basis. There are times when Interstate 5 is nothing more than a parking lot from Boone's Bridge to Highway 217 and even further north. As you know, over the years, many great minds have debated exactly how to resolve the traffic issues along that stretch of the interstate, and some progress has been made. However, the challenges are by no means resolved. One of the most recent attempts to resolve the congestion and plan for the future is what caused me to become personally involved in this issue. Fortunately for everyone, and in the interest of time, I'll spare you the details of the Highway 99-I-5 corridor connector debacle, only to say that one small part of that discussion was salvaged from that proposed plan, known as Alternative 7, and was eventually amended into Metro's Regional Transportation Plan for our area of the region. Feeling somewhat appeased as a result, SMBA, the communities of Tualatin, Sherwood, and Wilsonville, breathed a brief sigh of relief, thinking that part of a solution was within our grasp. That solution was an agreement to extend 124th Avenue from Highway 99 through to Tonquin Road and out to Boone Ferry Road, and then connect to Interstate 5 at the North Wilsonville-Elgin Interchange.
You can see that picture. Just a second, and suggest that I think we have a map.
Yes, you do.
In the packet that we've been given, that you might want to make reference to, and the committee might want to follow along as you're describing it. Those specific locations may be helpful. Okay. Sorry for the interruption.
No problem at all, because indeed that's the reason we gave you the map, because that depicts what we have in mind. And I think that carries you all the way through from 124th to 99, through to Tonquin Road, down to Boone Ferry Road, and then the connection to Interstate 5, and at the North Wilsonville-Elgin Interchange. You can see that there, I think, right? Correct? With all the local governments finally in agreement, including Metro, Washington County, Tualatin, Sherwood, and Wilsonville, we set forward about moving forward with the planning and right-of-way acquisition necessary, and there was an inquiry filed by Metro with the Department of Land Conservation and Development to obtain a Goal 14 exception in order to complete at small portion of 124th Avenue that was located outside the current urban growth boundary. Bear in mind, this was not any large-scale transportation, as has been previously discussed. It was not a west side bypass connecting McMinnville to Interstate 5 south of the Willamette River, or a superhighway or anything across prime farmland or through rural communities. It was simply a connection of roads that already exist within the three communities that would better facilitate travel from one neighborhood to another and allow for the future development of land that Metro has designated for industrial development. And for people like me and my fellow business comrades, it was maybe even a small step in the right direction that local government could take to make our lives and the lives of our employees a little better. Also, as it happens, since the area through this, which this new road extension would travel, has been identified for industrial development, one of the benefits now includes the creation of nearly 4,000 family-wage jobs, and a huge victory for Oregonians at a time when unemployment has reached heights not seen since the Great Depression. With all these tremendous benefits to be reaped as a result of this local government cooperation, it appeared that a real community victory was now upon us, and we would be able to enjoy the enhanced livability, less traffic congestion, and even new well-paying jobs within our communities to help restore the economic vitality that had convinced so many of us to invest and locate in the area in the first place. But alas, our feelings of joy and accomplishment were not long-lived when we learned of an administrative ruling by the Department of Land Conservation and Development that eliminated our planned course of action for implementing the plan we thought we had in our grasp. The April 2010 DLCD ruling to eliminate all goal exceptions throughout the state of Oregon virtually brought our economic and transportation plans to a standstill.
And Mr. Chanter, I hate to interrupt again. I'm just thinking at the aggressive agenda we have and the remaining things, and it's quite a list of people who want to testify on this bill. So if you could wrap it up.
I will wrap it up
please.
Right now.
Thank you.
As you can see, it has the support of the cities of Wilsonville and Tualatin. Presuming the opposed amendments are adopted, the City of Sherwood, the Chambers of Commerce of Wilsonville, Tualatin, and Sherwood, and the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Executive Secretary, who could not be here today. This is a good bill that will provide new jobs and enhance the livability of some important communities, and it deserves your support. I urge you to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to HB 3225 and send the bill to the floor with a due passed recommendation. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Chantron, if you could stay there, we might have questions for you after you hear from the rest of the panel. Mr. Rendy, do you want to give us the department's perspective, please?
Thank you, Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Bob Rendy. I'm a legislative coordinator with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. The department hasn't been consulted, really, or brought into discussions on this bill, so I apologize that we're catching up to it very late. And the concern that we bring, the primary concern we bring in the letter, may be something that we could work with. I want to just give you a quick history here. The Metro Reserves process came out of statute in the 2007 legislature. Right on the heels of that, LCDC was required to adopt rules for that region and did so with broad support. Counties, cities, interests in the region in 2008. Those are the rules, not 2010 rules, but the 2008 rules that are the problem here. Those rules, as I indicated, were agreed to at the time, make it very difficult to make changes in the reserves once they are designated. Now, the particular reserves we're looking at here are not formally designated yet. They haven't. That process is almost done, but it's not quite. LCDC was approached by the local governments in the region in 2010 on two different occasions, held a number of hearings and a lot of work group meetings on these rules, and a lot of that discussion was over roads in the rural areas in the counties or in the metro region. Very contentious. LCDC made a number of adjustments to those rules, and they very clearly signaled that this is all an experiment, this whole process. We don't have it anywhere on the state, anywhere else. We want to keep working together cooperatively as we do on this with all the parties in the region, and we think we will be making many other adjustments. Our concern, primary concern that I mentioned in the letter here, is the way this legislation is drafted, it will permanently establish that you can't build roads in these reserves. Now, that may be an effect of our rules. It's kind of subtle right now, but this bill would put that very permanently in the statute and then establish one exception for one place, which sometimes legislation does that. We're not always in favor of that, but we want you to think about what that would mean as we move forward with this process, and we want to adjust these rules. And we now face in statute a prohibition that would prevent us from doing that. So that's our main concern with the way this bill is crafted. But in doing some quick research, and I have to say it was very quick, so I may not get all the facts right, but our understanding is this is an area that will very likely be in the urban growth boundary very soon. The second thing we continue to hear is it's going to be years before this road is built. Quarry is still operating. Be a long time. And during that time, very high likelihood that this land will be in the urban growth boundary and this bill is unnecessary. So I do urge the committee to consider those two pieces of information as you consider this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and we're glad to have you back, Mr. Counselor, and I suppose in this building we should call you Mr. Leader or at least Mr. Representative. Thanks for coming back and shedding some light on this issue as well.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Co-Chair Benz, and members of the committee. My name's Carl Hostica. For the record, I'm the Metro Counselor for District 3. My district includes Tualatin and Wilsonville, Sherwood, all the areas that are being discussed today. And I'm basically here to answer questions if you have some, but also to essentially echo some of the sentiments of Mr. Rendy in terms of whether or not this bill is really necessary to accomplish the goals that the advocates have stated. We actually agree with all the goals that the advocates have stated. The transportation improvement that's being discussed is within our adopted regional transportation improvement plan. The area is under active consideration. The money has been identified to build the project, And at this point, the thing that keeps the project from being built, or excuse me, not even being built, but being planned, seems to be a requirement that you can't plan for urban level transportation improvements outside of the urban growth boundary. We believe at Metro that the bill is really unnecessary because we believe that that problem has a local solution, which is to bring it into the urban growth boundary. The mayor of Tualatin did bring this to our attention last fall and got a favorable response from what's called our Metropolitan Policy Advisory Committee, which is mayors and county commissioners from throughout the region. And all that we're essentially waiting for now is the completion of the entire analysis of the urban growth boundary, which we intend to complete this year and make changes in November. And I guess my prediction, although as you know as elected officials you can never predict what a body might do, my prediction is that the area will be within the urban growth boundary by the end of this year, which then says that the bill is not really necessary to solve the problem, but we also believe that it establishes a bad precedent for a legislative action on issues of this narrow scope. And as Mr. Rindy points out on line 10, when it says only if, the bill establishes a limitation on all other areas within the urban reserves that perhaps is not really intended by the sponsors of the bill. So it's sort of in summary, since I know you have a busy schedule, we believe that we can and will solve the problem locally. The bill is unnecessary. But if it turns out that we have not been able to solve this problem, then you've got the 2012 session in which you could address this subject.
Thank you very much. Are there questions on this panel? Representative Lindsay?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll actually have a couple questions, if it's all right, with Mr. Hostica. Just to be clear, it's my understanding that the extension of this 124th Road is currently not in the regional transportation plan that Metro has adopted, and if not, is there any guarantee that it will be?
I think it is within the regional transportation plan.
But it's outside of the urban growth boundary right now.
Yes, if you look at the plan, you'll see that a lot of areas within our long-range plan are currently inside or outside, but by the time it gets developed, that's the issue of whether it can be inside the urban growth boundary or not.
And is there any guarantee that it will come into the urban growth boundary?
There's no guarantees in elected officials.
Okay. And a couple follow-ups here. And to be clear, Metro does not have any objection to the development of the Basalt Creek area, correct?
No, we're actively promoting the development. We've invested our own money in planning down there. We've worked with the local jurisdictions to get it advanced.
Okay, and last question would be, if it were possible to proceed with building this road by obtaining the Goal 14 exception, would Metro be objecting to that request?
No, we don't object to that.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions?
I just want to make clear, we're fully in support of the project. We just have trouble with the process that's being proposed of having the legislature deal with this issue when it could be resolved at the local level.
Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my couple of questions, I'm not sure who should answer them, but the first one is, when is this road to be built? If tomorrow you could build it, when would it be built? Does anybody know?
That's a difficult statement because the actual property, if you have the map there, mm-hmm. that we're looking at, is currently an active quarry.
So where the road is proposed?
Where,
is
yes,
part of the quarry?
The area that there's a I don't have the map in front of me, but there's a rectangular area that's a quarry. That's the area that is the proposed urban reserve, which has not yet been approved as an urban reserve, but we expect to vote on that in about 2 weeks. And the proposed 124th on the maps goes along the west edge of that, if you can see that.
Yes.
And so that you would require a lot of engineering and a lot of work to actually put the road in there, but that's where it's intended to go.
So we'll keep that. Representative Benz's question for some of the other people who are going to testify later, but it's one I wonder about, too. Do you have another one?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anyone that disputes the value of the road? Should it be built?
No.
If not, then it seems to take an awful lot of time to move through this process. Is there something that anybody can say about if this is a good thing, what it is that's causing the delay, and what local governments can do about that delay? Because it sounds almost as if it's hopeless. Am I drawing the wrong conclusion from what I'm hearing, or am I hearing that indeed you see a way to get this done and it's just a matter of a very short time?
If you're asking me, we see a way to get it done, or at least to solve this problem of whether you can plan for it and build it relative to an urban growth boundary by bringing it in. We would expect that problem be resolved before the end of this year.
Go ahead. Okay, it is April. Mm-hmm. So that means 8.5 months is how long it's going to take to get that problem resolved. I'm not trying to pin you down. I'm just trying to say, is that the degree of time it generally takes to move from where we are today to where you want to get?
Well, I don't know what. I want to be honest answer to your question. It's probably about 6 months before we're intending to make that decision. And in the world of this kind of planning, that's a short period of time.
Thank you.
So, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot of my questions have been hit on, but how long has this process been taking right now to bring them to this point where they had to bring this before us? So how long have they been wanting to develop this? Because I actually will sneak around this way myself. A lot of it's gravel road and everything, so my wife won't use it, but I do, because it's a huge shortcut and it makes total sense. I'm just wondering how long they've been petitioning you to do this project and they've been held up on it.
You could ask somebody else how long they've been petitioning, but if you're familiar with the area, you might know that in 1997 there was a line drawn on a map to put a freeway there, and this issue's been discussed since then.
Are there further questions?
Yeah.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Two questions. First one, I thought I heard in sort of pre-committee conversation that the money hadn't yet been identified. I think I heard from one of you that the money had been identified. How much is it going to cost and where are we getting the money from?
We'll have to get back to you on the exact cost, but when I say the money's been identified, again, it's a technical question. We have what we call a fiscally constrained regional transportation plan, which is the plan that you make that's within what you expect to be your revenues over the next, I think it's 10 years mm-hmm. or 15 years. This is in that fiscally constrained plan. Mm-hmm. There has been money set aside to acquire right-of-way in this area, and there's money been set aside to begin the development of this road. But, again, I think Representative Widener may know the area. You have to come from Tuolumne and Sherwood Road, essentially across a quarry that's been recently inactivated, and come further down. So by the time you get this built, it's going to be 2 or 3 years easily. If you pass the bill today, probably more like 5 or 6.
We have a lot of fiscally constrained plans here.
Right. Yeah.
Did you have a follow-up?
One more question, Mr. Chair. To some degree, Carl, you answered the question, because that was my first blush. It was like, hey, not in a great position to evaluate the project. Sounds like people think it's important. Do wonder how much land use planning we should be doing, sort of, you know, bill by bill, committee by committee. And wondering if there are other, and I'll give a weird example, spent some good portion of the last session addressing water policy, a controversy raised in part due to the same critique. It's like, well, I don't know if we can be doing water rights by, you know, legislative vehicles as a general matter. Do we have examples where it either has worked or hasn't worked? Is this something that we do a lot, as sort of creating legislative exceptions to land use rules? Because maybe, you know, my question to the good representative bringing the bill might be off base. It might be a relatively typical thing to do.
Well, if you're asking me again, my impression is that it's very often proposed but very rarely enacted.
Maybe a follow-up to your question, Representative Smith, might be to ask Mr. Chanter how confident you are that in constructing the limitations that are in the bill and further described in the amendments, that you aren't inadvertently eliminating or making impossible some other good, reasonable, smart policy that might come up down the road.
There are probably those who could answer the question better than I, but obviously that's not the intention. What this is trying to get the cow off the ice.
Oh, I understand it's not the intention, but the question is whether that might be the result. In other words, have the restrictions been made so tight that you might come upon something at a later date that is now not possible because of the restrictions that are in this bill or the amendment?
Some of the staff with me will be able to answer that question a lot better than I can.
Okay. Other questions for this panel? See any. Thank you very much. We have four people who have signed up to testify, and I know we only have three chairs there, but since there are only four, maybe someone can bring one of those other chairs up. Akila Hurd-Ravitch, hopefully I'm not totally butchered the pronunciation, Monique Eichmann, Larry Harvey, and John Chandler, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Aquila Hurd-Ravitch. I'm the planning manager for the city of Tualatin.
Sorry for the mispronunciation. Thanks for being here.
That's quite all right. I'm going to talk a little bit about the area and the area that 124th will go through and a little bit about the concept planning work that we're doing. Southwest 124th Avenue is proposed to serve new and existing industrial areas in Tualatin, Sherwood, and Wilsonville. They're all located in Washington County. And all of the cities are currently working with Washington County on preliminary design work of 124th. The Metro's 2035 Regional Transportation Plan estimates there will be around 8,000 jobs in this new industrial area, and a little over 1,900 acres of land was added to the urban growth boundary in 2002 and 2004, and 124th Avenue is proposed to serve all of these acres and these industrial jobs. In addition to this industrial access, 124th is proposed to be a piece of the network that connects Oregon Route 99 to Interstate 5. So we're looking at it as a way to get from the state system to the federal interstate system. The Southwest Concept Plan is the area that is just to the east of 124th, and that's the planning work that we've been working on since 2004. There's a total of 614 acres. They're envisioned to be a mix of light industrial and high-tech uses in a large lot configuration with corporate campus-style settings and buildings. The businesses that we envision to locate in this area are going to be traded sector, high-tech, alternative energy, pharmaceutical industries, all with family wage jobs. And when the area is completely built out, we anticipate about 4,100 jobs to locate in the area. Based on our fiscal impact analysis, we estimate about $665,000 to the city in terms of property taxes. And we also think there will be about $1.4 million in TriMet taxes and about $9.8 million that comes from that comes to the state from income taxes. The road, 124th Avenue, is proposed to be the main arterial to this industrial area. It's also the primary access for the city of Sherwood's Tonkin employment area. Providing a connection from Tualatin and Sherwood Road to Tonkin Road in the most direct alignment possible is what we see as the best alternative to move freight through this area and to provide really a free-flowing arterial system. There's only two connections that are proposed on this road to really keep the traffic moving. And if there are any kind of curves or turns, that really slows down the free-flowing nature of the arterial road. And finally, we consider Southwest 124th to be a linchpin in our efforts to develop this land.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Reed and Benz and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Monique Beichman. I am from Tualatin City. I'm on the council there, and I am here to testify before you. As you can tell from the information package you received, the Tualatin City Council recently unanimously adopted a resolution in support of HB 3225. Urging you to also pass the bill and send it to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. We did so in hopes of encouraging you all in your elected capacities to help us do our jobs in our elected capacities. As you are all quite aware, public policy decisions about governance often overlap throughout Oregon. The legislature considers and determines statewide policy matters, and local governments are then charged with implementing policies and providing services according to these policies. All the interaction between state agencies, local governments, and city agencies involve a tremendous amount of interaction, and it usually, but not always, is worked out to everyone's satisfaction and to the greatest benefit of each community. In the particular situation we are considering today, some complications have arisen that we need your assistance in resolving. So we, the elected leaders of Tualatin, in conjunction with our partners in Wilsonville and Sherwood, can do our jobs. As you have heard, there's been decades worth of discussion regarding freight mobility and community connectivity throughout the South Metro area of our region. In conjunction with those discussions, our communities have also worked together to protect farmland and protect areas while still attempting to provide for sustainable growth and livability. Trying to resolve all these various concerns between multiple jurisdictions, including Tualatin, Sherwood, Wilsonville, Washington County, and Metro, is no easy task. But we have been diligent and worked hard together and believe we've arrived at a reasonable compromise and solution. More specifically, the area located between Wilsonville, Sherwood, and Tualatin, known as Basalt Creek, has been designated for industrial development where up to 4,000 new jobs will be created over the next few years. The City of Tualatin has been working on the concept plan for that area for quite some time now and has even begun meeting with the Wilsonville City Council to jointly plan the development of the area. The Basalt Creek development holds the key to several issues in this region, not the least of which is a reduction of traffic congestion and enhancement of freight mobility. It is critical to the future livability to our city and the region as a whole. But the first step in moving forward with this task is the creation of the transportation infrastructure that is necessary. When Metro adopted the newest regional transportation plan amendments that included the extension of 124th Avenue, we were relieved to think that we were finally on our way towards substantial progress. However, as you have learned, a portion of the 124th Avenue extension potentially lies outside the current UGB boundary.
Ms. Beichman, I wonder if you might be able to wrap up. I'm just feeling the time pressure here, and I think we're at least somewhat familiar with the map and the some of the arguments for it. So, if you could anything new, would be great.
Plead with you that this is something that we really need, and we don't necessarily believe that Metro will be able to resolve this issue within the next year.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Harvey.
Now, I'm just going to wrap up, Mr. Chair. There's been a lot said already, so I don't think I have any new evidence other than to, again, remind the committee that you've not heard any guarantees that this is going to get fixed anytime soon. You've heard that it'll probably get fixed, that it may get fixed, we'd like to get it fixed, and everybody seems to be in agreement, and yet there is no solution on the table other than the bill before you today. This is a solution to building this area out that's been identified by both Governors Kulongowski as well as Governor Kitzhaber as being significant to the recovery of the economy of Oregon. This is the way to get it done, and it's a very easy fix that we can hang our hat on. There is no other linchpin out there. So I'd appreciate it if you give it some consideration.
Thank you very much. Questions for the panel? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm probably asking at the wrong time. It may not be for this panel, really, but we have a packet from the South Metro Business Alliance, and in that packet is a map, but it's a pretty large-scale map of the immediate vicinity. I wonder if someone could provide us with a somewhat smaller scale map, in other words, showing a larger area so we can see how this piece fits into the larger.
Okay. I'm sure that someone is listening and will provide that. Thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, there are plenty of maps.
I'd be happy to send some maps to you.
Thank you very much. Don't see any other questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Chandler. You get the back cleanup.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builder Association. Your agenda is packed. We support the bill. We commend it to you. Please pass it on. Thank you. Any questions?
Well done. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much. That completes the list of people who have signed up to testify on House Bill 3225. Is there anyone else in the room who would like to be heard on the bill briefly? I don't see anyone. So appreciate the testimony and close the public hearing on House Bill 3225. Moving on to jointly open public hearings on House Bill 2007 and House Bill 3590. It's not 2000. Is there 2007 and House Bill 3591? Zach, would you like to give us a summary? And Representative Benz, are you going to be on the other side for this one? Or
not quite.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
House Bill 2007 makes legislative findings regarding water quality. House Bill 3591 requires the Department of Environmental Quality to consult with the applicant regarding Federal Water Pollution Control Act variances in order to seek to minimize negative economic impacts of variances.
I think I saw Representative Conger come in somewhere, but there he is in the front. Lost you for a moment. So if you'd like to get us started, please.
I was hiding in the front row.
Exactly.
Thank you, Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Bentz, members of the committee. First of all, thank you for your time and hearing this bill. I'll be testifying to House Bill 3591, and basically I just want to give you a quick overview about the genesis of the bill from my perspective. So a couple of months ago, we had an informational hearing in House Business and Labor Committee about the proposed rule by DEQ related to enforcement of the Federal Water Pollution Control Act, which regulates toxins in running water. And without going into a lot of detail about the outcome of that, there were a couple of things that I learned. One is that this rule, the proposed rule, DEQ rule, would set a standard in the state of Oregon that is, according to testimony that we've heard, at least 10 times higher, more stringent than any other water quality standard in the country. We also heard testimony to the effect that it is so stringent that if you were to take the drinking water supply from the city of Klamath Falls and pump it into a river, you would be violating the act because the amount of arsenic in the drinking water supply, the underground drinking water supply for the city of Klamath Falls is too high. And would not meet the standards. So the conclusion that I think many of us came to in the hearing was that no one is going to be able to meet these standards, and generally I think the testimony you'll hear today from others who I know are signed up to testify on this bill will agree with that. Now, what is the impact of this rule? Again, just going to the genesis of the bill, the impact is on point source and non-point source discharge into the running waters of the state of Oregon, as I understand it. So point source discharge would come from sources like municipalities, as well as companies that have a permit to discharge into the waters of the state. It would also affect non-point source, which would be runoff from activities related to land use. And the biggest examples would be agriculture and forestry, but I think it could extend to other things as well. So this bill only really addresses point source, or it's aimed primarily at the point source issue. And again, I think you'll hear more testimony about that following me. Now, if the standard that's being proposed is so high no one can meet it, then obviously, the question came up in our informational hearing in House Business and Labor, what are we going to do about it, or what's DEQ going to do about enforcement? And so that's when the first time I heard about the variance process. And the idea is that if your goal is ultimately compliance, but enforcing immediate compliance with the rule is either impossible or prohibitively expensive, then you have to have some kind of process to gradually bring people into compliance. This is the way I understand the variance process. And so in connection with applying for a permit to discharge into the running water of the state under the Federal Water Pollution Control Act as enforced through the rule by DEQ, an applicant could request a variance. And so at the hearing, we talked about this variance process. It seemed very amorphous to me, or very uncertain. I think many probably shared that concern. And in listening to this, a couple of things that I concluded for my own part. One was that the train had left the station on this. This is not something that we can, as the Oregon State Legislature, we can't dig in and solve this. Whether we think that the direction that the EPA is taking on this is right or wrong or indifferent, there is... Senator, welcome. Thank you for being here. I feel much better with, you know, having someone here supporting me. So the direction that DEQ is taking with this is kind of a foregone conclusion, because the regulatory enforcement is not driven from the state level, it's driven from the federal level. And therefore, what I think we decided in coming up with the language in this bill is, let's try to have a very simple approach that will give some comfort to folks that Oregon it remains open for business and is actually going to come up with a workable process for enforcement that won't lead to mass closures of businesses. And I want to add a couple of things about that. You have submitted in written testimony, I won't read it, but I just want to note it in passing. You have testimony from a fairly significant employer in the Gresham area that actually moved out of the state of Washington because of water quality standards that were this restrictive. So they moved their manufacturing facility from the state of Washington to the state of Oregon. And now we are facing having water quality standards, according to their testimony, very similar, exactly the same as the ones that forced them to move out of the state of Washington. They employ 480 people in a manufacturing facility. That's a frightening prospect right now, I think, for us, or it should be. And it's headed, certainly, if we lose those jobs, we're headed in the wrong direction. And I hope that none of us wants to see that happen. So what do we do about it? Well, again, the bill is intended to help with the variance process, and I'll let others add more detail, but one thing I did want to mention is just picture, if you will, what it means to be a potential employer who would discharge into the running waters of the state or would be discharging into a municipal sewage treatment facility that discharges ultimately into the running waters of the state, and to be told, well, you can't meet the standards of our rule for the state, but you can apply for a variance. And, you know, just trust us. Go ahead and invest say $10 million of capital here. Build out your plant, employ some people, and don't worry. It'll all be okay once you get through this incredibly expensive application process, which is already expensive. I mean, it's already expensive to get a discharge permit. But now add on to it that you can't meet the standards that are in the rules of the state, the administrative rules of the state. But you can apply for a variance, and you'll get it. I think the goal of the bill is to add a little bit of comfort, a little bit of certainty without derailing the train that's already left the station. We don't want, I think at the state level, we don't want to try to back up the process that's already rolling now in terms of the rulemaking, because the concern would be that if we do that, it's possible that it would be taken out of DEQ's hands, where we have some accountability and we have some support, and put into EPA's hands, and I'd be very concerned about that. So we don't want to do that. We want to try to keep it sane and down at the state level. With that, I'll turn it over to the esteemed senator.
Thank you, Representative Conger. And just so you know, Senator Whitsitt, we have public hearings open on House Bill 3591 and House Bill 2007, and a lot of people want to testify as well.
Thank you. I will be very brief.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsitt, representing District 28. Representative Conger has made a lot of the points that I would make, that these proposed standards are an order of magnitude more stringent than anywhere else on the planet. They're based on fish consumption studies, and I wanted to spend a moment or two addressing those studies that these things are based upon. The Department of Environmental Quality provided us with a list of five studies that they considered relevant. One of those studies, scientifically relevant studies, was nothing more than a summary of the summaries of other literature. One of them was done in the Puget Sound, and in that study they had excluded, it was an average fish consumption study, they excluded people who didn't eat fish. Think that would skew it a little bit? They selected people who ate the most fish, and not only did they include them in the study, but they gave them a higher percentage representation in order to make sure that they were well represented. You know, somehow you have to get to a point where people eat 140 pounds of fish a day, or 140 pounds of fish a year. I misstated that, but 175 grams of fish per day for 365 days is about 140 pounds of fish. That seems unlikely, but we haven't been able to reach that by, you know, manipulating the data, perhaps. The standards are based on modeled fish consumption. There's very little empirical data in those studies, and at some point in time, you would almost call them criminally negligent to use them, in my opinion. One of the studies in selecting the fish eating people, some of the people were eating canned tuna. Now, exactly what that had in Oregon or Washington, I don't know. Some of the shellfish that were being selected, what they did is they took the shellfish and they put them in a crucible and burned them to determine the amount of toxic or heavy metals and so forth in them. But they went to the local grocer and bought the shellfish. The researchers had no clue as to what country they came from. And yet we're including that. Many of the fish that are consumed by people who eat a lot of fish are ocean fish. And what effect Oregon waters have to do with the contaminants that might be accumulated in several years of a salmon being in the ocean is really hard to determine, but probably pretty minimal. So in general, the studies were very poorly done. So poorly done, we have an intern that comes in on Wednesdays, and Dale is a bright young guy. He is an economics major at a community college. And I gave him the assignment to look through these studies. You know, about 2 or 3 hours later, he comes into my office and says, "You're not going to believe this." And so my wife, who has a multi-degree geologist and went through the studies, and she was livid. I mean, these studies just don't make any sense. So anything that we can do to minimize the effects of these adoption of rules based on these studies, I think would be a wonderful, if we didn't get anything else accomplished in this legislature at all, if we could get that done, we could at least keep Oregon open for business a little longer. These regulations will have the effect of shutting down a good deal of industry, preventing other industry from coming in, and to the extent of flood irrigation, it'll virtually shut down Oregon agriculture.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you. Appreciate you being here. And any questions for either of the legislators before we let them get back to the rest of their schedules? Don't see any.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
Dick Peterson from DEQ, if you could come forward and help us get oriented as well. Beyond that, there's quite a number of people who want to testify, so I'll you're bringing someone with you. That's great. And Mr. Aldrich, did you want to be heard as well? No. Okay, so we'll stop here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Benz. For the record, Dick Peterson, Director of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality. With me today is Neil Mullane, who's the Administrator of our Water Quality Program at DEQ. And Neil's here to answer any questions, help answer any questions. I'll be the one that's providing some overview and testimony, if that's okay.
Yes, please.
And just for clarification, I was going to give some overview remarks. Would you like me to make remarks on the two bills at this time?
Or? I think we would benefit from your overview and whatever specific you'd like to offer. I don't know. Hopefully we'll have some questions for you as well.
Okay. And just for your benefit, I've handed out testimony on both bills. That should be coming around.
Thank you.
So both House Bill 2007 and House Bill 3591 stem from a proposed rulemaking currently underway at DQ that you heard the good representative and senator talk about just before me. First, in terms of overview, I was going to give just really a quick overview of the responsibility of DQ's responsibility under the Federal Clean Water Act. The state of Oregon is delegated the responsibility for implementing the Federal Clean Water Act, and DEQ is given that charge within Oregon.
Thank you.
Part of that delegation requires that we develop water quality standards. And water quality standards are set to protect beneficial uses of waters for people and their uses in aquatic organisms. We began doing this back in the 70s when the first water quality standards were adopted for Oregon. And under the Federal Clean Water Act, we're required to do periodic review of these standards. And when we adopt a standard, our Environmental Quality Commission adopts that, then it's sent up to the Environmental Protection Agency for their approval. These standards, when they're adopted, do form the basis and the guideposts for water quality protection programs, both for point and non-point source. So when we look at water quality standards and revise them, we do that to ensure that Oregonians are protected, in this case, from toxics when exposed to water and when eating fish. The plan now, we've been working on this rulemaking for some 5 years, and the plan now is to go before the Environmental Quality Commission in June with a recommendation for adoption of the standard. And if they do adopt and approve the standard, it will be sent to EPA, and it appears that EPA would, the earliest they would adopt the standard that we put up there is sometime late this year. Once that standard is approved, then we begin on the point source side implementing the requirements and permits as they come up for renewal. And in some cases, as was pointed out, these standards may result in permit discharges that are hard or maybe impossible to achieve. And so in some cases with toxics, that's the case without even approval of new standards. And these are for a variety of reasons. One example is there may be no proven technology for improving wastewater to meet standards. So since we've been working on this standard, we've been working on what we call innovative compliance methods. And these are methods to address current challenges that have been highlighted and provide additional situations under new water quality standards that we can implement through our implementing program. And these are included in the proposed rule. One of these compliance methods is called the variance, as was pointed out here and that these bills speak to. A variance is really an exemption from meeting the permit limit for a specific pollutant for a period of time when certain conditions are met. And these conditions are explicitly defined in our proposed rules. And in some case, one of those things, we ask for just a pollution reduction plan with the variance. So how are communities going to look at reducing that pollutant sort of upstream, if you will? So that's one of the things that we would be looking at facilities with. We already have authority to grant variances in our current rule, but no one has applied for a variance. And partly it's because the administrative burden for getting variances is very high. And that's what we're trying to address in the proposed rule. So the proposed rules are designed to streamline that administrative process, provide some innovative compliance methods, and ensure that permittees continue to make progress towards meeting the standards with the variance. And we've been working certainly closely with them. And we're going to provide and continue to work on that detailed implementation guidance as we develop the rulemaking. So that's just really a quick overview, and then if Mr. Co-Chair, if you'd like, I could speak to each one of the bills.
Very quickly, like? Please.
Sure.
And we do have your written testimony, which
yep.
It seems like a good summary too.
Okay. First two, and I'll keep this short. First two, House Bill 2007. House Bill 2007 stems from an anticipated adoption of the revised water quality standards, as I mentioned. And we have been talking with and reviewed the bill with those that are proposing it. And there are some unintended consequences in the bill, and amendments are being drafted as we look at 2007. And as I said, we've been working with the bill proponents to ensure that the bill accomplishes what the intent is, it's legally sound and workable, and doesn't contain any elements that would prompt EPA to disapprove the standard and adopt their own standards for Oregon, as was stated in the previous panel. So again, we're working on innovative compliance methods for implementing water quality standards, as I pointed out before. Again, House Bill 2007 addresses some of these compliance tools, particularly the variants and other things related to implementation of water quality standards. The bill largely requires DEQ to do work that is already intending to do with existing resources. However, some timelines for completing the work could make that difficult to meet, and we're talking to the group about that. The requirement to submit several reports to the legislature is new work, but not a significant workload. Once the amendments have been finalized, we'd certainly be happy to return to the committee to provide more detail on that. So moving to House Bill 3591, again, this one is dealing with a variance process for DEQ. It minimizes negative impacts to the extent allowable by federal law when considering an application for variance in its administration of the water quality permit program. It requires that we report to the legislature by February 15, 2013, on the number and types of variances granted and a summary of any conditions imposed or contained in the variances. It would limit any conditions imposed on the approval of a variance to those that are directly related to the purpose of the variance, and that an economic impact analysis to the permittee are economic impacts to the permittee are minimized. We do routinely evaluate work to minimize economic impacts to the extent allowed by the Federal Clean Water Act. So this bill is consistent with the way DEQ intends to accomplish the work, and we fully expect to consider economic factors in the evaluation of variances and to the extent allowable under federal law to minimize those economic impacts to the permittee. We have no concerns with the bill as it is written. The only new work is a requirement to report to the legislature in 2013, and this requirement would result in a minimal fiscal impact to DEQ. So with that, that's my summary, Co-Chair Reed, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. I'm sure we will have some questions. Maybe I spoke too soon. Representative Smith?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So as I gather it, sort of the EPA standards are getting, the states are adopting standards as the EPA completes their process. And what I heard in the earlier testimony is that Oregon's standards are more stringent than other states. But I don't know the timeline of the processes in the other states. Mm-hmm. What are the standards looking like in the states where EPA has completed their process?
Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Benz, Representative Smith, each state is on somewhat of a different schedule than our responsibility for reviewing water quality standards. In our region, Region 10, which includes Washington, Idaho, Oregon, and Alaska, Oregon is the first state in line right now to review this particular standard. Washington is starting their process here in the next month or so, and they're focusing on a higher fish consumption rate similar to what Oregon is doing, is my understanding. So it's a bit piecemeal, if you will, across the country, and that's sort of the lineup in Region 10.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Right. So are there any other states that have been completed and set their standards, and if so, in whatever region, mm-hmm. and if so, how do their standards relate to our standards?
Sure. Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Benz, Representative Smith, we have a standard, but it's based on a fish consumption rate that's much lower.
Yeah.
Some states in the Northeast, I believe, I'm not sure exactly which ones, but have approved standards at a higher rate, somewhere around 30 or 40 grams per day of fish consumption. And so everyone in the nation has a fish consumption rate-based human health criteria, and are often and are under review on what's called a triennial basis.
Mm-hmm. Let me try one more time.
Okay, sorry.
To ask, so where the EPA has completed their rulemaking process,
yes.
standards that have been set since then, are those sets of standards, ones that have been set more recently, is ours more stringent than those, the same as those, less stringent than those? Maybe that's a slightly more helpful way to answer the question.
Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Bentz, Representative Smith, other standards have been set. They're under review. Our standard as proposed, 175 grams per day, as far as states go, would be the highest one in the country. There has been standards set I think believe the Warm Springs Tribe has delegation of their standards and the Umatilla Tribe of theirs, and I think the Warm Springs Tribe is close to 175 grams per day and the Umatilla Tribe is 340 grams per day, and that's been approved by the Environmental Protection Agency.
I think we'll hear some testimony from the Umatilla Tribe a bit later, so we can perhaps clarify that. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to state my appreciation for the work that DEQ has been doing on these issues. They're difficult and challenging. We appreciate your efforts. I do wonder, even if these bills are adopted, and I hope they are, the challenge, the cost is still going to be great. Even just in trying to manage the compliance process. So when a small city like Klamath Falls with its arsenic issues or others have to come to the DEQ and ask for a variance, there's going to be a cost for that initial process and then the follow-up and then the follow-up and then the follow-up. Has the department done any work to try to determine what that type of cost is going to be? And how much warning should we be giving our cities about what they can anticipate when it comes to warning all of their ratepayers?
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Bentz, thank you for the comments. There was an economic study on the cost of putting these variances together, and it was estimated, I think, at $400,000, I believe. And there's a lot of concern that that's a grossly underestimate of the cost of variances. So we acknowledge that. What we're hoping to do, what we're wanting to do with this variance process is not look at a single discharge by discharge by discharge process, because that would be time-consuming, expensive, and so what we're proposing is more like a multi-sector variance process that would cover several issues and try to roll that together to reduce those costs. Those are the kinds of things that we're working on. And to answer your questions about should communities and ratepayers be concerned and aware, absolutely, and we would be more than willing and will work with cities and others to really understand what this is. But however, our intent with our rule, and I think what legislation like this would help with, is to ensure that we're taking the least cost route, looking at creative methods to grant the variances so it doesn't put a big time and cost burden on communities and provide certainty that they'll need. That's our commitment. That's what we're trying to do.
Thank you.
See any other questions? So thank you very much for being here. We have a fairly large number of people who would like to testify on these bills, so I'm going to call people up without particular thought to who you might be sitting with in panels of three. And in order to get through our list, we're going to stick to 2 minutes per person. I'll endeavor to say who's on deck as well. So John Ledger, Steve Higgs, and Phil Donovan, you're up first. On deck. And by the way, for the benefit of the audience, the sneaky trick of putting more than one person in each line doesn't work. It still counts as an individual person. Catherine Van Atta, Diane Barton, Sue Marshall, you're on deck, please. Who'd like to start?
I'll start, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm John Ledger, Vice President, Associated Oregon Industries. We probably represent the largest group of businesses affected by this, and I think we had a very good introduction. I'll be brief. But one of the things to remember is that this will be, and everyone uses the term higher or lower standard for ease of concern. The higher, tougher standard is the lowest number. So we don't get confused. This state will have the highest standard. There are some isolated places that have similar standards. They tend to be where it's federally imposed only, typically tribal lands. And I think you have in front of you something from a company that had to meet that standard. I think it was in Washington. It was tribal lands, and they had to move. And they are now in Oregon, and they're very concerned about their rates going up here. This affects businesses whether they discharge directly or not. If they discharge directly, most of them, many of them, are going to need a variance. We're not sure what it's going to look like. We know it will be expensive. There'll be great reductions in emissions any way you look at it. And if you discharge into a city system indirectly, when the city has to do new controls or incurs costs, those come upstream to that manufacturer discharger who may not be able to discharge, or even if they discharge no toxics at all, they'll have to bear the cost. And in some cases, this is extreme. There's a facility in Salem here discharges no toxics at all. It pays $800,000 a year to discharge into the city, and they're going to have to bear the increased costs on that. So it all goes up. This one of the things that was mentioned here, and we've enjoyed working with DEQ on this, it's been a good relationship, is if somebody is thinking about building here or expanding, and they know we have these essentially impossible standards to meet, and they know we're going to have tough controls. This is not a dirty water bill. These tough controls. They're going to have to meet these standards. Here's what they're looking at.
And that's 2 minutes, Mr. Ledger.
Okay. They're going to hope they can meet the standard. They can hope they get a variance. They may not. They have to apply for the variance. Then they're going to have to conform to the costs of the variance. That variance goes up to EPA, where someone in Seattle can approve it or disapprove it. They can sit on it for 3 months. And then if they even get a variance, it comes up again in 5 years.
Thank
so
you,
what
Ledger.
We're trying to do is just give them some assurance. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Higgs.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Higgs. I'm an attorney at the law firm of Perkins Coie. I'm testifying today with the Association of Oregon Industries in strong support of HB 3591. Just to echo a number of comments that Mr. Ledger made, as well as the Department of Environmental Quality, we are in actually support of the bill.
Mr. Higgs, you don't need to lean into the microphone.
Oh, okay.
It'll do
Sorry.
Just fine, and it won't distort when you're back a little bit.
All right.
Perfect. Thank you.
Three points that I wanted to discuss.
You don't need to lean into it. Just back up just a little
regarding
bit.
Regarding the cost.
Perfect.
Can you hear me okay right now?
Yes.
All right. Regarding the cost, first, the bill provides clear direction from the legislature to DEQ to minimize the costs in the variance process. And to our knowledge, DEQ, as noted today, has never processed an application for a variance. So there's likely going to be some bumps in the road that are unforeseen. And so this legislation direction will help business and DEQ work together to navigate those bumps in the road cost effectively. Second, the bill conveys an important message to minimize costs in the variance process well beyond the next five-year permit cycle. NPDES permits are for 5 years, and they actually can be renewed every 5 years. And so businesses that operate or plan new facilities require certainty that permit authorities will do what they can to ensure variances can be obtained cost-effectively over the long term if they actually are needed for subsequent permit cycles. Third, when DEQ reviews an application for a variance, it will be required to exercise its reasoned judgment as to how it handles the application process and whether or not it actually grants the variance in the first place. For businesses planning to expand or construct new facilities, this legislation provides an important basis to expect DEQ to minimize those costs associated with the variance process. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the bill. Happy to field any questions you may have. And, again, we respectfully encourage committee members to vote in favor of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Higgs, for staying within 2 minutes, even with our slowing you down on the microphone. Mr. Donovan.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. Appreciate the opportunity to comment on House Bills 207 and 3591. Provided written comments, and I'll just try and bang through a few talking points here. First off, as you know, these state water quality standards do not adequately protect Indian people. They're based on assumptions that are old. They ignored the much higher fish consumption rates of Indian people and others. In our minds, the fish consumption rate that's before you is very much a compromise. You can't justify the 17.5 that it currently is. We have documented to be 340 for our people. We've held our own state government and the businesses on our reservation to that higher standard. This issue has been an incredibly important priority for us for over a decade. It is not our intent or our desire to bring about burdensome new regulations, and as such, we sought to include fair and effective implementation measures. We've been involved in the process to date. We will be involved into the future, and if I could, just a few points about the specific bills themselves.
1 minute left.
Regarding 3591, Umatilla Tribes support efforts by DEQ to minimize potential negative economic impacts as the bill requires. We would also like to know the number and type of variances that are granted, which the bill mandates. And so we support this legislation. We would like to offer a friendly amendment. Costs and impacts are kind of the stated directive of the legislation. I think we're losing sight of protection of public health, and as such, I'd be happy to work with Representative Conger and John Ledger here to suggest some language that would make sure that what our goal here is conditions that contribute to full compliance with the Federal Water Pollution Control Act.
You have some suggested language on your second page of your written testimony.
That's correct. And then regarding House Bill 2007, recognizing that this is a work in progress, so just a couple of points. First off, the version that we have of 2007 right now has many reporting requirements. We would like to know the fiscal impacts of those. Secondly, we realize that questions remain about the implementation of the rules, but it should not be used as an excuse for delay, and that's how we read Section 7 of that legislation. Finally, we certainly do not object to measures that bring about cost-effective implementation. It's in all of our interest to have a workable law here. We don't want a complicated paper exercise. We want something that works. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here. Catherine Van Atta, Diane Barton, Sue Marshall, you're up next. And on deck, Kayla K. Edwards, Chris Fick, I think, maybe, and Peter Rothier are on deck. Who would like to start?
I would.
Go ahead.
For the record, Catherine Venata, Governmental Affairs Manager of the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. We've been working on the DEQ Advisory Committee process for the last 5 years, and we have felt that as we've gotten to the end of the process, that all of the implementation measures have not been present that the EQC promised in the fall of 2008. You have my written testimony coming, and it summarizes the remedies that we see for this problem and the amendment package that we will be bringing forth. We would ask for your support, but one thing I'd like you to do is flip to the back 2 pages of my testimony package, and you will have our cost report prepared by HDR Engineering that summarizes the cost of compliance with these standards without the use of a variance based on blind studies of 4 Oregon pulp and paper mills. And you can see that there are capital costs, annual operating and maintenance costs, and then you have an annualized cost for 10 years at 7%. And then on the second page, we talk about how much it would, we estimate that it would cost to get a variance from the type and the quality of work that we would like to perform to do that. And we summarily reject the DEQ SAIC report that said it would cost $25,000 to get a variance. We don't think that that would be appropriate. We'll be coming back to you with amendments, and I'd be available to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Did I get my 2?
You did. A minute and 45.
Good afternoon, Chairman Benz and Chairman Reed. My name is Dr. Diane Barton. I'm the Water Quality Coordinator of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, also known as CRTFIC. I provided written testimony, and I'm going to summarize some of the key points. In October 1994, CRTFIC published a report entitled The Fish Consumption Survey. The survey was reviewed and is supported by DEQ's Human Health Focus Group panel of scientists and risk assessment professionals. The CRTFIC document reports that tribal people are not protected by the current fish consumption rate used by the state of Oregon. CRTFIC's fish consumption survey provides a reasonable estimate of the fish consumption rate and patterns of tribal people. This is the report where the 175 grams a day that is protective of 95% of the population comes from. As Senator Whitsitt said, this calculates to 144 pounds of fish a year. I'd like to note that in a 2004 UN survey, the average American eats 275 pounds of meat a year. This is not an unreasonable number, and 144 pounds per year is protected of 95% of the population. It's not an average. The survey also reports that 97% of the people interviewed ate fish, and 88% of the fish that is consumed by tribal members originates in the Columbia River Basin. Since the surveys were published, as Phil said, Umatilla and Warm Springs have already raised their fish consumption rates. We have waited since 1994 for the state to take action on these findings and to protect the health of tribal members and other people who eat fish. House Bill 2007 proposes in Section 7 that any numeric water quality standard that is adopted does not become effective until March 1st, 2013. That will be 18 years and 5 months since the rate data was made public. And this data has proved that tribal people are not protected.
Thank you, Ms. Barton. We're at 2 minutes. Ms. Marshall.
Co-Chair Reed and Benz, members of the committee, my name is Sue Marshall. I'm here today representing the Tualatin Riverkeepers and Willamette Riverkeeper. We oppose House Bill 2007. I understand there's amendments in the works. We'd be very interested in participating in taking a look at those and giving our feedback. Our concern with this bill is based on the potential to undermine the state's implementation of the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act, by design, is an iterative process so that as water bodies and pollutants are identified over time, after the usual management practices have been implemented every 5 years, coinciding with the permitting, it becomes more stringent as time goes by and it fails to meet and achieve the beneficial uses. Some of the terminology that we're concerned about relates to whether the state determining what may be legal or practicable to control. I'll give a brief example based on the Tualatin River, which I think is a Clean Water Act success story, where phosphorus was the pollutant of concern. It was present in the background. It was concentrated and increased by human activity in wastewater. 50% or more of the wastewater that goes into the Tualatin River has these high levels of phosphorus. The most stringent level of control was placed on the Tualatin River in the world. Was backed up with a consent decree. They managed to meet the level well within the time frame and have gone on with innovation to create an economic stream flow by using the phosphorus to create a useful product. So I'd say it's difficult to know what might be practicable. That changes over time, and we wouldn't want to see anything set in stone that would undermine water quality for the state.
Thank you very much. Excellent timing, right on 2 minutes. Kayla K. Edwards, Chris Fick, Peter Roftier, you're up. And Mark Landauer and Andrea Salinas, you're on deck. Like to start?
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chairs, Co-Chairs Reed and Bench. My name is Carla K. Edwards.
Carla, I'm sorry.
I'm with Cascade Policy Institute, and I'm the Rural Policy Analyst. We agree with the core need of delivering a tool, which is the variance at this point, to deal with the different regulations that will be derived from the fish consumption rate. But there is a need to directly address the fish consumption rate and the regulations that are derived from it. And it is because of that that we ask that you include, as you make progress in 2007, a moratorium on the fish consumption rate rule and all rules that are based upon the fish consumption rate. We have found, as been said very well by Senator Whitsitt, some egregious errors in the actual science. And it is behooved to us as citizens of Oregon to actually reconduct the CRIPFIC study that was talked about. And in fact, in that study, it even expressed that there is a significant decline in 1994 in consumption rate at that point, among many other issues that are with that trouble with that issue. We also request that you have an expeditious variance process in place before the moratorium is removed, and that there should be those tools available before any of those rules go into implementation. And lastly, we ask that you ask in the moratorium that fish consumption rates are calculated with the consideration that salmon, in fact, are marine fish species, which will make a significant difference in the calculation. This rule applies to waters of Oregon, and it is important that when we apply these standards to the waters of Oregon that we are actually getting the benefit to the waters of Oregon that we need to have.
Thank you, Ms. Edwards. That's 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, other members of the committee. Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities. Municipalities have been involved in the process of setting these water quality standards for many years now, and the concerns we're expressing here have been expressed many times over. We simply want, like other supporters of these bills, some finality and assurances about this process moving forward. Oregon's blazing a new trail when it comes to water quality standards. These will be the strictest in the country by several orders of magnitude. We never question the science behind setting these standards. We realize that standards are designed to protect those populations that are most vulnerable, but we have questioned our ability to meet those standards. In particular, we're talking about the variance process, which will be needed to comply with these standards, DEQ's implementation plan, and the need to have a comprehensive strategy towards reducing toxic in our waterways that encompasses more than just point sources. Variances, as mentioned before, have never been issued by DEQ, have never been issued by EPA Region 10, and can be overly burdensome and can have a negligible impact on water quality standards. We want our ratepayer dollars to be spent more on items that can specifically reduce toxic pollution going into our waterways. HB 3591 is a simple bill, and we fully support it. 2007 is more complex, but it would explicitly address more of the concerns that we have, allowing for a multi-discharger variance, requiring DEQ to implement a pilot program or a demonstration project to walk through some of our municipalities through this process, address the difficulties in dealing with some of the legacy pollutants, like PCBs, and take into account the naturally occurring arsenic that's a result of volcanic soils in places like Ontario and Klamath Falls. We have concerns, like Representative Bentz, about the costs that DEQ may face in administering some of our concerns, but it should be noted, as Representative Bentz did, that these are costs that DEQ is going to have to incur anyway. We think that overall these bills will lower the costs, our compliance costs, and those for our ratepayers. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Interrupt here.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Peter Ruffier. I serve as the Regulatory Affairs Director for Clean Water Services, which provides wastewater and surface water management services to 500,000-plus people in 12 member cities in Washington County. As you've heard, we have been successful in the past at dealing with innovative approaches to address water quality concerns and issues, specifically with regards to the Tualatin. Clean Water Services operates 4 wastewater treatment facilities which fall under the permitting requirements that would be directly affected by the proposed rules that DEQ is considering. We support the objective of the legislation to provide some clarity with regards to the process for variances. Variances require a very high level of demonstration and high evidentiary requirements. They also require EPA approval, and as you've heard, that process has not been adopted or put into place in Oregon previously, and EPA Region 10 has not effectively reviewed variances and responded to them. The state has undergone some efforts to try and work through the variance process, and in consultation with other EPA regions and states, I can say that the conclusion was that while variances have been put in place in other areas, they're not simple, they're not straightforward, and they take a long time to work through the interpretations and the actual steps of the process. We would appreciate the clarification that the bills would provide and how variance processes work. We would also, I think, look to see clarity around how the variance process leads to meaningful progress towards addressing the water quality concerns that we have. Right now, the variances are supposed to be limited and temporary, and they're based on having to do some studies about whether or not technology or other advances allow you to come into compliance. We don't see that process working out very smoothly.
Thank you, Mr. Ruffier. Appreciate you being here, and apologize for the mispronunciation. Hard to read the handwriting here. The last two people we have on the list are Mark Landauer and Andrea Salinas. While they're coming forward, let me take the opportunity to announce, much to my chagrin, given the lateness of the hour, we are not going to be able to hear House Bill 2202 and House Bill 2201 today. We'll be carrying those over, so any of you who were waiting in hopes that we're going to get there, I don't think we're going to be able to do it. So, Mr. Landauer.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Mark Landauer with the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our association represents approximately 900 special districts across the state of Oregon. Many of those districts are, in fact, impacted by the rules currently being considered by the DEQ and the EQC. In addition to some of the suggestions that Mr. Ruffier provided to you for House Bill 3591, or I should say 2007, we do have a couple other suggestions. One would be that House Bill 2007 should be amended to allow municipalities to use background pollutant allowances. As you know, some of the Oregon's rivers, as previously mentioned, do have natural levels of arsenic and mercury, and we believe that that is a positive suggestion that will improve the bill. Another suggestion that we have is we recommend that the DEQ and EQC adopt an implementation plan development process for each class of chemicals that are likely to be exceeded under the new standards. Each implementation plan would detail how the appropriate water quality compliance tool under the Clean Water Act would be developed to resolve the underlying standard violation. While Oregon is sort of leading the charge on this issue, we are fearful that the state businesses and individual ratepayers will bear the brunt of the costs of implementing these new standards. Idaho and Washington are not currently considering similar rules, so these rules will have little impact on the overall health of the Columbia River fish. We fear that these rules are going to place businesses at a disadvantage and industries at a disadvantage in Oregon. However, we do believe that both of these bills will limit the costs that will be borne by the state and individual POTWs. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony.
Well done. I was going to wait to the end of your sentence to cut you off. Thank you very much. Ms. Salinas.
Chair Reed, Chair Benz, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the Legislative Director with the Oregon Environmental Council. The Oregon Environmental Council opposes HB 2007. Oregon has a problem. The fish swimming in our rivers are toxic to eat because of pollution. This is unacceptable to Oregonians, and it's unacceptable to the federal government. DEQ's current human health toxics criteria were rejected by the EPA because they don't provide adequate protection for Oregonians who eat fish and shellfish on a regular basis. If DEQ does not adopt standards that protect human health, the EPA will. And this bill seeks to circumvent the Environmental Quality Commission's rulemaking on water quality standards to protect human health. We have numerous concerns about HB 2007, and Section 6 and 7 are the most alarming. Section 6 requires DEQ to revise water quality standards in a way that it essentially gives up on protecting human health, which could result in EPA, again, rejecting Oregon standards and stepping in to promulgate standards for us. Section 7 delays the implementation of more accurate water quality standards. Section 4 and 5 tie DEQ's hands in determining how best to issue variances. DEQ has already developed rules that address the issue of background pollutants, and DEQ has the ability to issue variances. Using pilot variances or multiple discharge variances is not necessarily a threat to the environment, but we believe DEQ can and should determine whether individual or multiple discharges work best rather than being tied to one approach. We believe it's bad policy for the legislature to step in and override the stakeholder input that shaped the toxics water quality standards rulemaking. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Salinas. We appreciate everyone's willingness to stick within a short time frame. And that completes the list of the people who have signed up to testify. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on House Bill 3591 or House Bill 2007? Please come forward.
I'd also like to mention for the record that Clackamas County Water and Environment Services submitted written testimony.
Thanks, Zach.
Care before me.
Very well.
Thank you.
That was even quicker. With that, then we'll close the public hearings on House Bill 2007 and House Bill 3591 and open, with the remaining time we have, a public hearing on House Bill 2327. Zach, if you want to give us a summary, and Mr. Slack, if you want to come up and get us started, I'll see who else should join you, perhaps Darren Lane and Alex Kyler.
House Bill 2327 allows county to charge permit and inspection fees for utility lines in county road right-of-ways, not to exceed costs incurred to the county.
Mr. Slack, I'll give you, what do you think, 3 minutes? There are a whole bunch of people who want to be heard, and I don't think we're going to get all the way through it, but we'll do our best. 3 minutes enough?
Yes.
Okay. You're on.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I want to thank you for hearing House Bill 2327, and I would call your attention, if you have it, to the -5 amendments at this point, because this is a gut-and-stuff bill. The Association of Oregon Counties wishes to express its support for the passage of 2327. This bill will allow counties to be reimbursed, and I want to emphasize, be reimbursed for processing of permits and conducting of inspections for the construction of utility infrastructure within county right-of-ways, and also for maintenance and preservation of those lines when the road surface is compromised. Pursuant to ORS 368.016, the exercise of governmental powers relating to a road within a county is a matter of county concern. To that end, counties manage county road rights of way to ensure efficient and safe movement of goods and services to the public and to visitors of the state. The counties also issues and conducts inspections to a variety of utility service providers that locate infrastructure within the right-of-way. And a little bit later, Mr. Chair, you'll get a graphic that shows a cross-section of a road right-of-way with the myriad of utilities that you will find in many of the county roads at this point. The -5 amendments provides that the fees that could be charged by a county, and I want to indicate that this is optional. Counties may. It doesn't mean that they have to. This is permissive. That these fees are based on either the actual cost or the average actual cost. So we have put some sideboards on these provisions at this point. The -5 amendments also provides that the county establishing a fee that is authorized by this legislation will provide a report providing the basis of the fee to all affected utilities 30 days prior to the enactment of any fee so that they have an opportunity to participate. These amendments, the -5 amendments, are the result of a half a dozen meetings that were held over the last 8 months with the utilities to address this issue. House Bill 2327, again, allows counties to charge a fee for service, no more. The bill is not a request for franchise fees, as we have brought before the legislature as recent as 2009, and it is not a tax.
That may be a good place to stop, too. We have just a few minutes until Representative Greenlick will be walking through the door. I'd like to hear from as many as we can, so as quickly as you can go, gentlemen.
Chair Reed, Chair Benz, members of the committee, my name is Darren Lane. I'm the Linn County Roadmaster, and I'd just like to call your attention to two items that I've submitted for your review. First is written testimony in support of House Bill 2327, and the second item is the graphic that Mr. Schlack referred to, which gives you sort of a, obviously not every mile of every county road looks like this, but these are the kinds of utilities that you find in the road right-of-way. And to be brief, I'll tell you that we have approximately 1,100 miles of road in Linn County that we're responsible for, and we have issued in the last 5 years about 1,500 right-of-way encroachment permits at a cost of about $360,000 to our agency. We've recovered about $45,000 of that through fees, permit fees that we are allowed to charge for various things. And we are currently issuing permits. It's costing us a lot to do the job that we need to do to coordinate with utilities. But we're not able to cover our costs associated with that. And these fees, if we're allowed to charge them in Linn County, they're going to be very reasonable, ranging from, say, $50 to $125, depending on the complexity of a permit. and they're going to be based on our actual cost, and they'll help us ensure that we can do a good job of coordinating with the utilities, issuing permits, quality permits in a timely manner to ensure the safety and protection of the roadways for the traveling public. And I appreciate your genuine consideration of
thank you, Mr. Lane, particularly for the graphic. That's very helpful to visualize what we're talking about. Mr. Kyle?
Thank you. Chair Reed, Chair Benz, I'm Alex Kyler, Lane County Intergovernmental Relations Manager, here today in support of House Bill 2327. You've got my written testimony. What I wanted to focus on is the table in the written testimony that outlines the revenue loss that we're experiencing under the ramp down and sunset this year of Secure Rural Schools funding. If I could bring your attention to the second column from the right, that is the United States Forest Service revenue that is dedicated to road fund, and you can see over the 4 years of the Act how that decreases over time. And in fact, we look to the very bottom row there, and we expect to go back to actual harvest levels in 2012 and beyond at about $2 million per year. Road fund balance right now in Lane County, about $75 million and going down by approximately $10 million a year. We expect this cost recovery bill to, if it were passed by you, to bring back about $100,000 a year in permit fees, and we ask that you support the bill.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. We'll try to move along as quickly as we can. Brant Wolf, Barb Young, Ted Case. On deck, Scott Bolton, Mark Landauer, Mike Dewey. And I don't know how far we'll get in this list. When Representative Greenlick walks in, we'll shut it down quickly. Would like to go first.
Brent? Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brant Wolf representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association. You'll have my written testimony here in just a few minutes. I'll hit the high points. Attached to my testimony is a fee schedule from ODOT, which was established a few years ago, without commenting on the particular level of the fees, just an indication of what we're up against. The issue is the fact that when ODOT established their fee schedule, we had some information about the elements that went into the fee schedule, how they came up with some of those fees. And until very recently, we didn't have any information about this, and without that kind of information, it's difficult to gauge what kind of an economic impact this is going to have on our customers. Many of our members operate in multiple counties. Barb Young, one of our largest member, operates, I think, in all 36 counties. And to the extent that this would mean 36 counties, 36 fees, 36 different ways of developing the fee, it could be administratively kind of a nightmare for some of our members. Unlike some of the utilities affected by this fee, if it were to pass, the telecommunications industry is a highly competitive industry, and we want to make sure that this is a competitively neutral permit fee. In other words, it's applied to everybody who provides telecommunications services. That's an important thing for us, and the fact that the bill mentions utilities, many of our competitors are not utilities as such. Finally, one issue for the committee to consider. In cities where we have franchises and we pay franchise fees, if we have to pay a permit fee of this type, we get to deduct that permit fee from the franchise fee that we pay to the city. We would like the committee to consider allowing a deduction of this permit fee from whatever property taxes we pay on the facilities in the right-of-way that we're talking about. Those are the high notes. I'll be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you very much. Ms. Young?
Co-Chair Benz, Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify. My name is Barb Young. I'm the Legislative Director for CenturyLink, and I just will support the comments that Brant put forth. Our major opposition to this bill is the fact that we have no certainty with regard to what this fee schedule may look like. Early on, the counties provided us a document showing average permit inspection fees ranging from $27 to $579 per county. So that's a wide range, and again, lends to our uncertainty of what this permitting expense may be to our company. We would view this as just simply a blank check that we sign, hand over to the counties, and they fill in the amount, which is inappropriate. And as Brant said, our second major concern is that this be competitively neutral. This bill appears to be targeted toward utilities only. Many of our competitors that are in the right-of-way are not classified as utilities, and it would put us at a competitive disadvantage if we're assessed permitting inspection fees, and they are not. Thank you.
Case.
Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Benz, members of the committee, my name is Ted Case. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. I appreciate the opportunity to comment today on HB 2327. I think the previous two witnesses have outlined many of our concerns. One of the things that I've learned talking to our engineering and operations folks that are out in the field each day and working with the counties, and by the way, I think we have a very good relationship, working relationship with the counties, but the engineering operation guys are very concerned about the patchwork quilt nature of this legislation. As you've heard, 36 potential different schemes and procedures, and they're very worried that this is going to hinder their ability to protect the infrastructure and improve the infrastructure, which is our mission. So we're very concerned with this legislation and urge the committee to oppose it.
Thank you very much. Are there any quick questions for this panel? I think this is probably a good place for us to stop, given the entrance of the committee staff from the next committee. Don't see any. Thank you very much for being here. For the benefit of those in the audience and anyone else interested, we will endeavor on Wednesday to hear from those who had signed up for House Bill 2327 but did not get a chance to testify today. There are a few of those folks. We will also carry over House Bill 2201 and House Bill 2202 to our Wednesday agenda. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2327. Is there anything else to come before the committee today? I apologize for the quick movement through so many, but we got through a bit of it, and no one's listening anymore, so we'll adjourn the committee.